If I was to ask you, what do you think would be the key qualities to making any relationship work well, I wonder what would go through your mind. Obviously, when we talk about marriage, we kind of get a little bit more concerned about it at times, one, because of the enormous amount of divorces that take place even among Christians. The idea is that if we were to pick some, I sort of thought of five myself as I was doing some research this week. It wasn't like a high-level survey of 1,000 people or anything, but it really talks about certain things, and usually at the top of almost any list is the issue of communication. If you can't communicate, your relationship's going to be poor no matter what you do. The second one that often pops up on the list is trust. You rarely can do anything if you don't trust people. It doesn't matter whether it's your spouse or whether it's a friend. If there's anything that throws question upon the issue of their credibility and your ability to trust them, then there's extreme difficulty in building any kind of relationship, much less marriage. The third one I want to suggest to you is respect. There's so many families, especially ones that marriages that end in divorce, where respect is one of the first things that go out the window. And often it's because people feel like trust has been broken or betrayed. And then the communication usually deteriorates from there. The fourth one is compromise. I have a daughter who now is engaged and getting married in August, and so we have that to look forward to. She is, I won't tell you her age because she probably wouldn't do that, but she is a few years out of university and high school. And I tell you, we've been in a long journey where she's actually dated guys who said they were Christians, but literally didn't live up to what she wanted. And she's been faithful to not just settle, but to really pray and just try to discern what the Lord wanted for her. And we believe, as we've interacted with him, that he has the kind of respect for her, but more importantly, a love for Jesus that isn't just a placard on his forehead, but a passionate commitment of his heart. I usually tell most couples that I do premarital counseling, the biggest issue you're going to face in your first couple of years of marriage is that you're still thinking like a single person when you're married. I can do all the things that I want to do. I think those are fine priorities, and often they find that sometimes you got to make some sacrifices. You got to make compromises in order to make the relationship work. And then obviously, last but certainly not least, is the concept of commitment. That faithfulness in marriage and in relationships is kind of an unknown commodity at times in the world that we live in. It's, hey, I'm committed to you as long as you're doing all the things that I expect, and the moment you step outside of that, got nothing to do with you, the easiest out is I just leave or find some other answer. As we begin to move into the concept of Mark chapter 10, I think Jesus is going to give us a perspective that's more than just a skill set. Obviously, you could go to an unbelieving marriage and you can go to unbelievers and they would acknowledge and affirm these kinds of qualities. The communication is critical, that trust is essential in the process of marriage and even family. Respect and compromising not core values, but compromising my behaviors and way of doing things is absolutely essential if we're going to grow and flourish. And then, of course, commitment is kind of a common sense reality that if there's no commitment built on those things, then most things will ultimately fall apart. But what Jesus does is he's stepping into the religious culture of Israel where the Pharisees and the scribes are still working off the Old Testament law, and they are the ones that have come to Jesus in Mark chapter 10, and I want to read through the first several verses here and give you a sense of just the tone and the context of what's going on. And it's one of those weeks I forgot to put the text up, but anyway, I'll read it, and I'm going to read from New American Standard just so that I catch the full drift. He says, starting in Mark 10, "And rising up, he, being Jesus, went from there in the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and the crowds gathered around him again. And according to his custom, he once more began to teach them. And some Pharisees came up to him, testing him." So they're not really curious about learning anything. They're trying to box him in and find another fault with what he is and who he is. "They came to him, testing him, and began to question him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce a wife. And he answered and said to them, 'What did Moses command you?'" So Jesus starts immediately with what they know, or what they think they know. And they said, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. But Jesus said to them, because of the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this commandment. And then the passage we're going to spend time in today is 6 through 9, not the first 5. And it says, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. And consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. You know, marriage is kind of one of those things that's been reshaped and redefined and all kinds of things. And sometimes we struggle responding to all the different things that are going on in our world. One of the things we probably need to give more attention to is just our own relationships. It's easy to criticize people around us, but it's another thing to have the kind of marriage that flourishes and honors the Lord. So I want to walk you through some things that you're probably going to go, well, this is pretty basic, but I've learned after 30 plus some years of ministry, I never assume anybody knows anything anymore. And so if it's boring to you to understand some of these fundamental basic things, you'll pardon me from just taking the scriptures and reminding you of them, but I hope that you have a heart that wants to listen to the Spirit of God in this in the first place. The first thing that Jesus does when he gets to verse 6 is he talks about from the beginning. And he is obviously making a reference back to the time that God created everything. And it's a reference to Genesis 1 and 2. At that particular element, it tells us that God created man, and that word man is a generic reference to humanity, because he goes on further to talk about them being male and female. And this becomes, as it were, God's blueprint, God's the designer and the architect of how he created humanity. The language is appropriate to the question because of what the Pharisees have asked. And so Jesus is going to start back from the beginning. By the way, it's always good, and Jesus does this automatically, is that when we've got questions about things, it's always good to go back to what the scriptures say. It's easy for us to try to ad lib and ad hoc and try to come up with our own creative solutions, but the issue is, even Jesus, as it were in this reference, goes back to the beginning and says, here's the way the original designer created things. And he does this because if you don't have a good starting point, if you don't have a good foundation, you'll never know how to navigate the process. Being that God created Adam and Eve, and he put them in the garden, I thought it would be appropriate to describe what a great marriage looks like from the idea of tending a garden. It says, both partners work together to cultivate a flourishing relationship, planting seeds of trust, respect, and affection. They nurture their bond with care and attention, watering it with love and understanding, and removing any weeds of resentment or misunderstanding that may threaten to choke their connection. Through their joint effort, they watch their love bloom, and it grows over time. Well, it seems pretty straightforward, pretty simple. But I tell you, in all of the pressures and the hardships and the tensions and the stress of life and work and finances and raising kids and creating frenetic schedules, there are all kinds of marriages, and Christian included, where marriage is pretty hollow and empty. There's so many demands and so many expectations and so many overwhelming things to deal with that the strain on the actual relationship is pretty severe. And so what ends up with couples is they go through the motions of getting things done, but rarely working on their relationship. And so this is why often what happens is when couples have kids, they're so preoccupied with raising kids that when they become empty nesters, so many of them get divorced because they look at each other and go, we got nothing left here. And there's feelings like, I don't love you anymore, which is kind of the mistaken issue that love is a feeling that we'll deal with. But the issue is, I've lost my desire to invest in this, and I want something different. I put all my time and energy over the years into this, and this is what we've got to show for it, which in their mind is minimal, and so I want something different. The issue in all of this is that first and foremost, he talks about creating the male and female, and I think it would behoove me not to mention that human beings were created by God, and they are created in his image. Now, the one issue that I don't have a problem taking on once in a while is the thing of evolution. I'm not a fan of evolution. I think it's probably the wildest, crazy demonstration of blind faith that you can create, because there's no, in spite of the fact that people try to use science to justify it, there's no real scientific evidence to demonstrate evolution, that we are simply, without any intelligent being, without any sentient involvement of anyone to create a design, we are just mere accidents that just happen to occur over time. It's not the way our world works. It's not the way this thing develops. And it becomes, to me, difficult to remove the imprint of God from human life. Because the moment you do that, then like anything goes. It's literally the survival of the fittest, that there's different kinds of races of human beings that are, some are clearly superior than others, and there's no footing for morality or any kind of ethical decisions. That literally anything can go. And what's critical is that every human being is created in the image of God, male and female. And that makes everybody valuable. We'll discover by the time we get to Genesis 3 that it doesn't make us good anymore, but it makes everyone has value. I don't care what their status in life is. I don't care what their struggles are in life. Every human being, male and female, have intrinsic divine value because they're created in the image of God. And it behooves us to be simply condemning of other human beings because they're different. And at the heart of this, we need to understand that God is the architect of life. He's created human beings, and he is the one that's going to be the architect of marriage. And he has a right to say how this develops and what it is. God is the one who's the architect. In light of that, we have to understand, I always think of three particular things that touch our lives, and this is particularly true after Genesis 3 in the fall. But God is the one, when he created Adam and Eve, that gave them an identity. And it's way too complex to deal with the whole thing here, but clearly that was them as individuals. Both of them shared image of God equally, and that image is anchored to the God who created them. So their idea of their identity is always anchored to God's creative thumbprint upon their existence. He is the one who created them, and their self-worth is always built into that image and into the image of, or their relationship with him. You start separating that, and people's images are really going to struggle. The second one is significance, my sense of purpose, my value. What difference do I make in terms of this world? And the more disconnected an individual is between them and their creator, the more they're going to struggle with their significance. The more they're going to try to figure out that, well, if I get married, then I'll have value. If I get married the right person, then I'll find acceptance, and then I'll find my self-worth. I think it's a terrible reason to get married. It's great that someone reaffirms your worth, but if you're depending on that to give you self-worth, then you're in trouble. In my counseling, I usually ask people, why do you want to marry the person you want to marry? And often, I'll get this answer, they make me happy. To which I respond, or my evil twin responds, what are you going to do when they stop making you happy? Because I'd even be willing to take a poll. Is there anyone here who's been married for any length of time where they are in perfect happiness, their spouse has never disappointed them or made them unhappy? Yeah, I dare you to put your hand up. The flock of humans, I can't see you up in the balcony, but I'll dare you to put your hand up if you think that's true. It's just not possible because of the damage to who we are because of evil and sin. It's just marrying for that purpose puts way too much responsibility on your spouse to do something that only God can satisfy. And it's absolutely critical that we understand this in our marriages, because usually marriages disintegrate because the other person isn't making me happy. And so that it becomes a struggle. And then the third element is security. That I just want someone to look after me. I just feel alone and I feel insecure. And that sort of gives the impression that being single is wrong, and it's not. You don't have to be married to be normal. You don't have to get into a relationship to have self-worth and significance and a healthy identity of who God has made you. And to marry into any relationship for that purpose is going to end in struggle or disaster. And I want to make sure we're clear this. After Genesis chapter 3, and I'm assuming you know that, but if you don't, Genesis 3 talks about Adam and Eve making this decision, even though they didn't have a sin nature, to rebel against God and to eat the fruit that he commanded not. And then everything from death and sin and suffering and evil and death entered into the world. And I want to make sure this is clear, is that when that sin happened, everyone who follows in Adam and Eve's footsteps, everyone has an identity problem. Everybody has an identity problem. Everybody struggles with significance. And everybody struggles with security. Now, if you happen to grow up in a home, in some respects, that was pretty secure and stable and everything else, you might not struggle with these things as much as somebody who is in a real abusive home, but we all struggle with it. Because the great commandment says, love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and if you don't do that, then you're looking for security and significance in other places than from our Creator. Issues of anxiety and worry, selfishness and greed, all become symptoms of the problem of sin and evil that's damaged us as human beings, and we start looking for the answers to these things in other places. For some people, things like identity is extremely severe, and they struggle with who they are. So we end up with things like suicide and other kinds of symptoms where they are trying to do things to take away the pain of not knowing their identity. Significance is also a struggle. I'm worth nothing. I can't contribute anything. I make no difference in the world. Why should I live? Even compared to the people who think they're God's gift to everyone, that if everyone would just listen to me, life would be better. Those are all struggles with identity. Those are struggles, as it were, with significance and security. It's often camouflaged and sort of with arrogance and confidence and other kinds of things that affect who we are. But I want to make sure we all know that every single one of us struggle with those things. And ultimately, while the scope and nature and magnitude and the intensity of it is different from person to person, for some people these things are very debilitating, for others they seem to find ways to cope with it, it affects everyone. And I will propose to you the only solution that anybody has is to get right with their Creator. That he is the only one who can give us a proper identity. We can try to reinvent ourselves from now till kingdom come, and we might pacify our own struggle, but we'll never find the solution in terms of who we genuinely are. At the heart of this, our significance can only be found when we surrender to God and understand his divine sense of imprint and purpose for our life. And only when we allow him to be our security that he can dispel issues of anxiety and worry and other things that go along with it. So when they ask the question, can a man divorce a woman for, what's the grounds for that? You just sort of see this dripping in some respects, even though it's a test, with this whole problem of identity, this whole problem of significance, this whole issue of security. And it'll get more complicated when we come back to that text and deal with some of those issues. But Jesus goes and ends up quoting two different verses back in Genesis. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So when we think about marriage, I want to think of it in the stages Jesus talked about. The first one is he says they have to leave their father and mother. Now that may feel very cultural if you move out of the house and live on your own like I left them a long time ago. Obviously back in these particular cultures, women usually were stayed under the protection and the authority of their father till they often got married. Otherwise they'd usually just stay in the family unit, and they had huge multi-generational almost communities in terms of families. They were large, they were big, they looked after themselves. They developed their own little infantry, as it were. This was pretty self-contained until a man would marry a girl, and then the man would leave his family, and she would leave hers, of course, in all the complexities and process that they would do. Now, there's some obvious common sense here that I've noted, so if this doesn't seem overly brilliant, then I guess we're on the same page. But we have to realize the healthier the family, the better chance of a healthy marriage. Now, it's not a total one-to-one relationship. I've seen people come out of terrible situations, and somehow they're able to develop a totally new pathway and behavior system when they get married. It didn't happen because they got married. They were able to find a different pathway than what their family established for them. But the more damage that's in a family, the harder it is to create healthy marriage. Because to some degree, when we get married, we sort of bring in all the good stuff and the baggage that comes from that family. Usually it sort of boils down to things not quite as catastrophic as, like, why are you cooking food that way? That's not the way my mom did it. Why are we folding the towels and doing that? Why don't we put things away? It gets down to all these little habits that we learn growing up, which unfortunately actually have caused divorces because they can't seem to compromise and get on the same page with some of these things. And we chuckle at it because we know that we've been through experiences where we've had these colossal fights over which way the toilet paper is supposed to roll. However, if you're a product of divorce because of these things, it isn't quite as funny, because the trauma of the demands and expectations that you need to be my slave and conform to my way of doing things can be very dehumanizing. But the issue is that they're to leave. And what I mean is, in the essence of this, is that since the essence of marriage is designated and designed by God, when a man and woman come together, they need to be in right relationship with him to understand the very nature of marriage. Now, I don't mean just marrying a Christian if you're a Christian, because there's lots of Christians who marry Christians who really struggle with relationship, not because they're not Christians, but because they don't have this vibrant, intimate relationship with God. I mean, I've said this in lots of sermons, especially when I was back in Portland, but just because a person's a Christian doesn't mean you should marry them. That's not the one litmus test that, oh, okay, I guess it's good, regardless of whether they're passionate for Jesus, whether they have a prayer life, whether they want to serve Jesus and pursue him. It's more than just a label. But the other side of leaving mother and father is the word leave literally has the meaning to leave or depart that emphasizes on the finality of the action. And I probably don't even have to tell some of you what that means. Because what happens in a lot of situations, and it's sort of one of two things, is sometimes children don't really leave their parents. They're still glued at the hip, and so their spouse is fighting, not just trying to do what is unique to them as a family, but the other spouse keeps dragging things into the home that this is what mom and dad want us to do. And they keep leveling expectations about how this marriage should go. And the danger is that if you don't really make a decisive sense of leaving, and we're going to create our own family unit, and we're going to develop things that we work on together, it's fine if our parents want to give us wisdom and coaching, but they don't have the right to start dictating how we're going to do our marriage. They might pray about it, which I don't know anybody that wouldn't want their parents' prayer. But of course, the other side of it is there's often a lot of parents who don't know how to not meddle. They are always trying to tell their kids, even when they're married, what to do. It gets worse when they start having kids, because every grandparent is half the time bursting at the seams trying to go, they're not doing it right. Well, I'm glad some of you have gone through that. And grandparents sometimes really struggle. When I went out to see our kids, I'm always worried about their spiritual health, those kind of things. And I think I told you this before. We were at a wedding last July, and my wife's nephew was getting married. And so I was playing with some of the kids out in the backyard, and my granddaughter came over to me. I started singing Jesus Loves Me to her. She kind of looked at me weird and ran off. probably because of the way I sing, but in any event. So I went in and told my daughter, I said, man, I was singing Jesus Loves Me, and she ran. She goes, Dad, that's because she knows you have an agenda. I went, yeah, why not? That's what grandparents do. They've got an agenda. Like, why wouldn't you have an agenda? Well, it's one thing to sing Jesus Loves Me. It's another to start trying to force your kids to do it the way you did it. And one of the great problems that happen in marriages is parents who can't leave things alone. And if you're wondering whether you're one of those families, just ask your spouse, do my parents meddle too much in our relationship? Well, maybe that's not a good idea. I take that back. You can go there at your own risk. But if we don't resolve these things in our own marriages, we're going to have way more troubles than we even deserve, because either the couple can't not keep dragging parents into this, or the parents can't get their fingers off of it. And there is a sense that leave means leave. Decisive. Stop. We love to have you around. Stop telling us what to do. Now, obviously, there's a sense that we have the freedom to speak into one another's lives, but it's mostly how we do it, not often that we do it. For most of my kids, I've always said, if they ask, I'll answer. Some of you are going like, even if you're not asking, I'm answering. So the heartbeat of this is they need to leave father and mother, and they need to cleave to their wife. The idea of cleave, we're not going to exegete it in extent, but I want to borrow a statement from Malachi chapter 2, and because God is communicating his judgment upon his people. They're going through all the religious activity, they're offering sacrifices and everything else, and God's not pleased with them. And one of the reasons comes up here in verses 12 through 16. The second thing you do, he's got a grocery list of things they're not doing well, you cover the Lord's altar with tears, with weeping and groaning, because he no longer regards your offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. And you say, why does he not accept our offering? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and wife by covenant. One of the things you need to notice in the Genesis account that Jesus quoted is that they become husband and wife before they have sex. Before they become one flesh. And what's critical to understand is that marriage is not defined, as it were, by the idea of love. Love does not define the nature of marriage, it describes the health of a marriage. Just because people love each other does not give them the right or the entitlement to say we can be married. The idea is that love isn't the issue. The issue is, when we get married, we enter into a covenant, and we do it by the vows that we exchange with one another. And as you notice in Malachi, God is a witness to those promises, to those vows that they make to one another that actually bind someone in the covenant of marriage. It's not love. Love's the motivation by which we go to marriage. It's the fuel that will invigorate and give vitality to marriage, but they're joined as husband and wife before they jump into bed, if I can put it that way. Now, the sexual intimacy is a vital part of how they consummate those vows and, as it were, seal that relationship. But love is far more than an emotional attraction and affection. It doesn't define the nature of marriage. People enter into marriage by covenant, the exchange of vows, not by love. So I've had people have conversations with me and say, well, if people love one another, then they should get married. And I said, well, love isn't the qualifying issue. It's whether you are exchanging vows and entering into a covenant. And so as we begin to think about it, Jesus makes it clear as he quotes Genesis and how God originally designed and was the architect of marriage, that the husband, as the man is joined in relationship to his wife in the covenant of marriage, and then they become one flesh. And that is really, in a sense, the capacity of marriage. It may seem very obvious, but I will propose to you again that the way God architected this is that sexual intimacy was designed by God for marriage. And I'll even go so far to say, as the Bible describes all sexual activity in any form, any shape, any segment of it, as being immorality outside of the context of marriage. So I don't care whether it's pornography, I don't care if it's a swingers club. Might even make a point that, hey, it's not even being heavily involved with somebody without actually doing the act. That the issue of sexual intimacy was built into the blueprint of marriage between a male and a female. And that becomes what God's design accentuates in terms of what God created there and what Jesus responds to when he says, in the beginning, here is God's blueprint. Now, let me add one more point. The idea of becoming flesh is that marriage is an exclusive relationship between one man and one woman. And the heartbeat of this is that intimacy in marriage is exclusive. This isn't something to post on Facebook or TikTok, although lots of people seem to think that that's a good idea. It's an exclusive element and privilege and benefit of what happens in terms of marriage. It's not, in my opinion, from what the scripture says, to be flaunted in terms of our culture. Our culture loves to do this. That's the way they make money and get bucks and get people hooked to things. But the issue is, it's intimacy is a marriage is exclusive in becoming one flesh. The very nature of marriage is exclusive. There's things that we'll talk about when we jump to the New Testament and talk out of Ephesians, that there's issues that the Bible uses called headship and submission. And that is specifically designed to describe the nature of relationship between a man and woman in marriage. And we'll touch on some of those pieces as we do it. But the purpose of marriage has a certain exclusive element to it. When you get to the New Testament, Paul's going to say, this is a reflection of Christ's love for the church. So it has a very exclusive, unique. You don't see that described anywhere else about any other institution. But this marriage is to reflect Christ's love for the church. So men, if you're married, your example is Jesus, not the culture. You might be inspired by other men's way that they care and love and show affection to their wife when they're out, but your model is Jesus. And wives, as the church, as it were, is to submit to their husbands, you're to do that, and, you know, that's just setting you out because you're going, oh, I thought we got rid of those terms. I thought those things, like, were archaic, that it doesn't fit the egalitarian movement. Yeah, you're going to have to wait. If you want to hear about it, come back later. But that's the capacity of marriage. There's a certain critical exclusiveness that should happen in marriage that doesn't happen outside of it. And so there's an element of here that's critical, a deep love, intimate relationship that continues to flourish. And just to say the obvious, what Jesus does here is then he says, and what God brings together, and it's interesting that there's that phrase, God brought this together, one, because he's the architect, doesn't mean that unbelievers can't get married. He gave it to, in a sense, humanity, not necessarily just to Christians. But the idea is that as you begin to walk through this, he says, what God brings together, let no one separate. So some final thoughts on this is simply this. Marriage is designed to be participative. Most of you know marriages that have either fallen apart or often got pretty stale. People who live in the same house and they kind of go through the motions, but they're constantly like ships in the night passing each other. There's no real life. There's no energy. There's no kindness. There's no, as Ephesians would say, husbands has long since stopped nurturing his wife. The wife has long lost respect for that. So they exist in the same room, but they don't have this vital sense of growing love and intimacy that's the way God designed it to be. It's designed to be permanent. This isn't like eating meals where you change the recipe up every once in a while. The heart of marriage was meant to be permanent. And when you look into the New Testament, that's because Christ's relationship with the church is permanent. Even in the Old Testament, when God, as it were, uses language like, I wrote a writ of divorce with my people because they've become so pagan. And the language that the Old Testament uses is pretty graphic. But then God restores them. His faithful love continues to be there because of his covenant with Israel, not because of their faithfulness to it. And it's designed to be powerful. It's designed to be powerful because, to be honest, the Lord does not need more Christian marriages as much as he needs marriages that are deeply committed to Christ. Sometimes we get satisfied saying, well, I married another Christian and we're good. That's why I have no problem, and I don't apologize for it, saying just because someone's a Christian doesn't mean you should marry them. You want to marry someone that has a heart and a passion to serve Christ, and they take responsibility for that relationship, and they're willing to work at it, and they're willing to sacrifice time and energy to make sure their spouse is encouraged and strengthened in their relationship with Christ. And that works both ways. And yet sometimes the hardest thing we do in our marriages is have spiritual conversations and spiritual discussions and even pray for one another because we're so on task with getting so many other things done that the last thing we do is even pray. Let me finish with another metaphor. A successful marriage is like being part of a winning team on a lifelong journey. Both partners support and encourage each other through the ups and downs, celebrating victories together and weathering the challenges as a united front. They recognize that they are stronger together than they are apart, and they navigate life's twists and turns hand in hand with unwavering commitment and solidarity. You know, if this very basic reminder of the foundations of marriage seems pretty common knowledge to you, that's okay. As I say to a lot of people, at stages like this, I don't care what you know, I want to know how you live. If I interviewed your spouse, said, how's your spouse doing in terms of revitalizing your faith and encouraging your growth and supporting you as an individual and helping foster an environment where Christ is the centerpiece of this relationship, what would they tell me? Because what happens is we get so intentional about doing some more things, we just sort of put our marriages in neutral, and we just let the inertia allow it to kind of keep drifting in the wake of all the other activities that we think are so important. And so I just want to, as I've had a chance to keep doing this, and frankly, I don't know any married couple that you're not constantly trying to review and examine kind of where your marriage is how's it really going? What's the nature of your relationship? What does it do for you as an individual? Because you know Satan and the world that we're living in wants to drive a wedge between you and your spouse. He wants you to get annoyed at the littlest things in life. He wants to harden your heart so that at some point you get to a point where you're going like, yeah, I don't know if this is worth it anymore. And instead of saying, my partner doesn't make me happy anymore, I want to encourage you that if there's any rub there at all, get before his throne of grace and say, Lord, what has to change in my heart in order to revitalize my relationship with my spouse? Because the moment our mindship shifts to the point of you need to change rather than I need to change, I've just seen too many go down the road of ending in disaster because it's always their fault and I can't fix it anymore. Marriages are worth it. Marriages are holy, they're sanctified, they're God's created institution to help our world flourish. And I know for Barb and I, we want to be part of the solution, not part of the struggle. We all have struggles. But as long as we respect and communicate, we make compromises and sacrifices, and we try to keep Christ in the center of it, we're going to march hand in hand through life in the journey to the very end. So help us, God. Father, we live in a world where there's just so much pain and suffering. We know that the scriptures tell us that there's going to come a point where people literally try to forbid marriages and encourage people not to do it because there's likely so much pain and tragedy and hardship and failure that it just seems at times that it's not worth the effort. That there's way better ways to enjoy the benefits of marriage without the commitment. Marriage is one path of journey that many of us are on. There are others who remain single who haven't lost anything because they're not married. Father, help us to stand before you as individuals and make sure that we have this vital relationship with you that is so powerful and transforming that whether we're married or not, we make a difference in people's lives for your eternal purposes. But if we step into the covenant of marriage, help us to give enough time to the relationship that it serves your purpose and glorifies you. And for this we pray in Christ's name.